Hi, and welcome to the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. I'm founder and director Frank Cifaldi, and we just got a little bit of a holiday update show for you today. Joining me also from the foundation are Robin Kunimune, show producer. Hi, Robin.
Hello.
And Phil Salvador, our, what is our cool librarian title that we gave you?
Library director.
The library director of the Video Game History Foundation.
And it's true.
And yeah, so last you heard from us, we let you know that the show proper, the Video Game History Hour, is on a little bit of a hiatus as we sort of figure out what's next for us. And we did sort of say that you might hear from us in the meantime. And well, here we are. So really, I think one of the first topics we kind of want to talk about is that we're in the middle of our annual winter fundraiser. And this is actually a really important time for us. If you've donated to us in the past, you probably know this, that there's really only one time of the year that our charity, the Video Game History Foundation, does this sort of direct ask of donations so that we can sort of figure out what it is that we want to plan on doing next year. So this year we did things a little bit differently. We kind of came up with this notion of a holiday countdown calendar, sort of an advent calendar, but instead of that crappy plasticky chocolate that you get at the Walgreens, every day is a digital video game history treat. And Phil, I kind of want to point this back at you, but you know, I think part of this for me is being able to sort of show the breadth of the kinds of stuff that we ingest into the library.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons we hit on this idea is because I think a lot of folks maybe don't know exactly what it is that we do. I know we, you know, people graciously support us, I think, because we support the concept of video game history and video game preservation, but it's often not clear what that looks like. We often say that we're building this library of materials, but it's like, okay, well, what does that mean? I think people know us for our magazine library is one of our big things that we have, but we also have, we kind of nebulously say, behind the scenes materials for games. And so like, what does that mean? So we are, yeah, we're trotting out a wide variety of stuff, things that, you know, are fun treats to receive. Like, I think people don't want to get like, hey, here's, you know, a PDF with a bunch of like meeting minutes. Like that's the juicy stuff for us as historians, but it's not like a fun treat for the holidays. So we're bringing out a lot of them. Like we have a photo of this. We have a cool scan of this. We have some flyers. We have some interesting videos we got, but yeah, kind of showing the breadth of what we have beyond, I don't know. I think people may, to an extent, still think that we just have, you know, games on a shelf and that's what we do as an organization. But no, we have all this really rich material that I think as we're sharing it, people are starting to dig into it and starting to really get ideas about like how you can use this to study video game history. Just today, as we're recording this today, we shared out a video of an awards ceremony from 1999. And I noticed a comment on YouTube that just popped up a couple minutes ago where somebody pointed out that Pokemon Red and Blue are nominated for awards under the name DMG Pokemon. And so there's a little thread on YouTube asking, what's the story here? What's going on here? It's like, yeah, this stuff is fun. But when you start digging into it, you start to see more about how things are being presented and contextualized and all this other stuff. And that's kind of, we like to seed that and show like, hey, you can do research with this stuff. So I think it's nice to get that stuff out there and show like, this is a collection of cool research material you can actually use.
Yeah. You know, I think, like you're saying, it is sort of a showing the breadth of the kinds of things we collect, because it's really hard to convey that unless you're, you know, unless you have firsthand access to the material, which people don't yet, but we're working on that. We'll talk about that later. But more than that, actually, like this countdown calendar that we're doing, we kind of identified recently as we're sort of figuring out what's next for the foundation that we're really good at finding the right things and we're really good at collecting those right things. You know, like we're really good at being sort of this friendly face of game preservation that's sort of trusted throughout the industry, that, you know, we've talked about it on the show in the past, like show up and dig through Ed Zemrad's basement and, you know, digitizes things, right? And we're really good at getting that stuff we're really good at then ingesting that stuff and cataloging it and adding it to a collection. But what we're not so great at is reliably talking about it, is reliably presenting video game history to people. It's something where we struggle with a lot. Like we do some content, up until recently we had a bi-weekly podcast, this show, right? we have the occasional sort of long form blog post. There might be a little bit of a YouTube presence that goes along with that. Our Twitter account, shows things like magazine advertisements and cool stuff that comes in and things like that. But realistically, like, I think we could do a lot better at explaining to people, why it is that we do what we do, and sort of telling this sort of micro history with it. And so this holiday countdown calendar, which I didn't even say, gamehistory.org/donate is where that's located right now. This is sort of us testing the waters to see, like, first of all, can we talk about things without it taking over our lives, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because Phil and I are both just, very hardcore researchers, and we spend a lot of time making sure things are factually correct, et cetera. Like, can we sort of, like, can we take our investigative hats off for a second and like just speak from the hip, right? Like, quickly about history. So we're prototyping that, seeing if we can do that. But second, we're also kind of trying to see what it is that resonates with people, right? Like, when we're pulling out a flyer from Nintendo from 1985 from a prototype piece of hardware that they didn't end up selling to people, like, is that, do people respond to that? Do people respond to the AIAS awards that Phil just mentioned? Do they like historical photographs of important people or moments throughout history? Like, we're sort of getting a sense for what it is that excites people, so that we can sort of cater what we do toward that.
Yeah, and not that we can, if people respond to, like, this one-of-a-kind rare thing, we can't just be like, oh, let's bring out 20 more of those. Like, obviously, things are limited by what we have. But yeah, it's a Frank just smiled.
No, but we can go, okay, maybe we invest the time to make YouTube videos about that topic. You know what I mean? Like even if it's like... Right, exactly, right? Like we might not, it's like, oh, I guess we need to buy one-of-a-kind prototypes until the end of time, because that's all the people care about. No, but, like, we could, like, double down in how we talk about that, and we could, like, generate podcast episodes and YouTube videos, et cetera, et cetera. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Phil.
No, yeah, I think it is what you're saying about, like, us having to just, like, see what works. I think it's been interesting this month because we're going into sort of, like, wow, cool robot mode for a little bit, where it's like, normally we would say, like, here's this video of E3 and then write a 2000 word thing about comparing the presentation. But it's like, no, it's like, hey, check it out, it's Banjo-Tooie. Like, that's great. Yeah. Like, we're having to go into that mode for a little bit, but, like, that's what gets people
dinosaur
excited.
Planets in here. That didn't come out neat, huh?
Exactly. Yeah. But then you can start digging deeper into it. I think going back to what you were saying though about, I don't know. I think this in a lot of way about, the fact that we're haven't been as good about communicating this stuff. I think I can understand how that's frustrating from an outside perspective too, because it's like, hey, we got this thing, we're preserving it. And then there's just kind of radio silence to an extent. It's like, I think we've been working on this for a long time. Like, we have not just been sitting on stuff. We've been, like, building our library and doing all this stuff. And we're getting to a point now where it's like, we're getting ready to start showing people, hey, this is what we've been up to. This is what we're building towards. And I think this is a good sort of sample or flight of that, where it's like, hey, here's a little bit of this, here's a little bit of this. This is the kind of stuff we've been preparing at a much larger scale than just a couple neat tidbits we're sharing over the course of this month.
Well, I think that's a good segue. We were going to talk about this later, but let's just kind of talk about it now. Something that we've been building, at least philosophically, if not literally, since day one of the foundation, is this idea of a digital library of video game history. And it's something that Phil, when we brought you on, your job was just build this, right? Like,
yeah.
And we're not quite ready to launch, but we are ready to at least give a little preview of it.
Yeah, I think looking at our schedule we have for the rest of this month, by the time this podcast goes out, I think within a couple days, of this podcast going out, there will be a demo we're going to be showing off how the library system works. And I'm really excited about it. I think it's the kind of thing that it's not, you know, there's not going to be like a post on Polygon like, whoa, check out this cool thing. And it's a, you know, 15-minute instructional video on how to use libraries. But like, it's going to be useful for people who to understand what it is we're doing and like where we're pointing towards that. It's like, hey, this is going to be the access point for getting these things. Like, I think there's going to be some good demonstrations of, you know, if you're doing research, some use cases, like here's how this thing is going to be useful for you. And I think even though we have some cool things we're going to be showing, even still some big things coming this month, which I'm really excited about, this one's the biggest for me, not just because it's my full-time job and I'm showing people what I've been doing for the last 2 years, but it's also like, hey, this is what the foundations, I think we've talked about it as like, this is what our product is. And now we're actually showing this off to you. Even if it's not like, you know, hey, we have the prototype of Banjo 3E, which we don't, but like, it's not that kind of thing, but it's exciting in for me in this way, where it's like, this is the roadmap for what we're going to be doing in the next year.
And it's been cooking for quite some time. So we're pretty excited.
Oh yeah. I mean, when I say from the beginning, at least philosophically, like Patreon day one in 2017 was, you know, the you have to fill in the thing on Patreon. It's like creator name is building blank, right? And it's like I said, a digital video game library or something to that effect. Like this has been the vision the whole time. It's just, and it's, you know, there's been maybe arguably little pokes and prods at it as we're sort of putting things on, for example, the Internet Archive, right? But we've never been able to point at something and say that is our library. And it's just taken honestly this long and this much work to get to a point where we're satisfied that we're creating a product that's useful. And I think there's a whole show about this eventually, but I just kind of want to say that for me anyway, it's a lot of what we're doing here, and I think you would agree with this, both of you, is that the way that digital video game history material is accessed by people right now, it's a mess, right? It's just kind of like files are uploaded, you know, disparately around different like
it's
websites and things
west.
Like that. And, you know, the video game magazines are scanned by different groups who don't overlap with each other or even promote each other sometimes. And they're all pushed to the Internet Archive that are pretty hard to discover. Go ahead, Phil.
I was going to say, it's not even that the material is kind of disparate. It's that the information around it is disparate. Like even thinking about one of the things we've been sharing this month so far is we have 2.5 hours of footage from E3. And a lot of that footage exists online, like not our same footage, but like there is other video of E3 2000 and you look it up and it's like, hey, this video fell off the back of a truck. Like it's not clear where from exactly. And so this was, I think the moment this really set in for me was as we've been preparing all this, you know, we're doing write-ups on each of these items. So it's like, hey, here's this thing we have. This comes from XYZ. And there were a couple cases where I needed to look up like, okay, well, where did this come from? And I just went to our library system and checked the metadata we've been adding to it. And it's like, oh, we're referencing this internally now. It's like, this is good. Like this is going to be a thing people can actually canonically reference. And sometimes that'll be like, when was this video game magazine published? But other times it'll be like, hey, where did this video come from? And we can describe that and share that with people. So having a place where we can get all that together. I mean, it sounds silly to say we've been working on this for 2 years, but we've been working on this for 2 years. Like it takes a while to get all these pieces in place.
And we've been spending a lot of that time building back-end infrastructure, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. A lot of it has been figuring out how to make all of it work. Not to spoil the instructional video coming out, but like we have, you know, we have one system that is like the catalog and another system where the content lives and they do not talk to each other very easily. And so a lot of it has been figuring out like, how do we get these things in sync? How does all this communicate? Which has been challenging. But
that's going to be a fun show going through that and letting Phil, first of all, explain our custom tool, Bubsy. Do not explain it yet.
Okay.
Let's just leave it at that we have a tool called Bubsy.
We did have a conversation once where our director of technology, Travis Brown, was in town and we were all talking and someone said out loud, do you think it's a good idea to give Bubsy access privileges, admin privileges, was the
quote.
Did you end up giving Bubsy admin privileges?
Bubsy is an admin in our system. Yes.
Great. Good.
Okay.
But I mean, our ultimate mission here is to make people better video game historians, right? Like we want video game history to be better. And, you know, this library that we're building is a tool to make that easier. And it's very ambitious. It's, you know, I'm never going to be satisfied with the content that's in there. Like, you know, because it's just video game history is infinite. But I'm really excited to sort of point at it and be like, this is the vision. Cause I think it's really hard for humans to visualize new ideas unless it's in front of them and working already. And I think if we try to explain to a lot of people, even those who study video game history right now, what we're doing, I think the reaction of a lot of them would be like, well, just throw it on the Internet Archive, you know, like you have a way to do this. And I think, you know, my hope anyway, is that this demo will be able to show like, no, look, we built tools to be able to actually like research this in a way that makes sense to normal people. And that may create new opportunities in video game history. We might hear new voices start to study this stuff. And that's something I'm really, really excited about.
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought, been thinking about the library as, you know, is this a value add to what we're doing versus just kind of putting everything in a Google Drive? And I think most things we're showing this month, like all the little tidbits of like, here's a picture, here's a, you know, a scanner, a video, like these are things that either will be in the archive or are already in the archive we're building. And I think I got a question from someone saying like, hey, where is this stuff going to be preserved? And right now it's like, oh, it's on YouTube. And I think we're all kind of familiar with the fact that YouTube is not permanent, right? So I think it's the idea of like, we are going to have a permanent home for these things where they will be contextualized and there'll be more meaningful ways to access them and discover them than just putting things up in a shared platform with, you know, millions of other uploads where we get copyright strikes because there's music in the background, which I think a lot of what we've uploaded so far has gotten YouTube copyright flags.
Almost because everything that we've uploaded has gotten a YouTube copyright strike. Yeah. We cannot monetize, but we aren't anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Not copyright strike. We're not getting like, you know, like yeah. banned from YouTube.
We're not allowed to monetize the videos that we've uploaded.
Not that we're building the library to be like, oh, we can make money off this. Let's run ads next to our design documents. Like, no, that's not a thing. But no, I think it's just good to be getting this stuff out in general. Show like, here's what we're working on. And isn't this cool? Next year, at some point, we're going to have a place where all of this lives and you can access all of it in its own little environment. That's exciting to me.
Yeah. And it just goes out. It goes back to this notion of like, we don't do a good job talking. And I think a lot of that's coming from like, look, we can talk, but it's boring right now. You know,
I would say you talk about it, but you talk about it very insular. Like you don't talk about it to people like me. And for people who don't know the context yet, I know very little about video game history. I am always the dumbest denominator in the group. Like I never know what we're talking about. I always have to ask for context. But for other people like me, and I know we have listeners that are more like me, where we're just like, what? What does that mean? Tell me. Like we're doe-eyed and happy to hear about it, but we don't have any context, so we need you to speak more simply to us.
Right, of course, yeah. And it's just there's nothing to talk about other than we're building it. You know,
yeah.
Phil spent the last month cataloging magazines. It's not that interesting.
You're building the runway, though, right? Because what you're saying is you're building a tool to make it easier for more like amateur historians to start practicing and doing what they want to do. Like, oh, I'm curious about this one little thing, and make it very easy and approachable for them to find out and present it. So then people like me can have more avenues to consume. And you're building the ecosystem.
And at the risk of talking kind of cyclically about this, I think that's also why we're leaning into some of the fun stuff too, is for this month is being like, hey, here's a big trade show, as opposed to like when we were trying to brainstorm ideas, I was like, oh, Frank, check this out. We have this cool design document. And Frank would say like, how do we put that in a thumbnail? And it's like, that's a good point. So that's
wait,
so
did this you say thumbnail or thumbnail?
Like visual thing that I put on a calendar that people click on.
Because fun mail is also a thing. Like, how do we make this fun?
Every mail from the Video Game History Foundation is fun mail. But point being, yeah, it's also helping us kind of build up our chops for, like, how do we communicate these things with a larger audience in a way that's not just like, hey, sicko historians, we have the organizational chart for this company. You want to dig into this and see who was doing sales? Like, that's exciting for us, but we're also getting better at sharing the stuff that'll excite people.
Yeah. You know who was really good at that is Summoning Salt, who we had on very early in the podcast. Like, he makes something that is so niche, extremely accessible to the layperson. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, he's awesome at that. Yeah. Yeah. Since that podcast has converted into doing that as his job. So,
oh, that's fantastic.
There's a lot more Summoning Salt than last we heard from him. you know, happenings around here since we last spoke. Robin, you and I, and Amanda, who's been on the show as well, attended Portland Retro Gaming Expo in October, where we put on an annual pop-up museum exhibit. And this year, slightly under duress, I say, I describe this in my other podcast, Insert Credit, as jovial duress. Under jovial duress, put on an exhibit on the Atari Jaguar, which is a system that only historians should know about. it is very much an also ran. It was something that just never really resonated or had the software support it needed, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, we built this exhibit to sort of be able to explain that, like, look, this wasn't a joke, you know, like real people actually believed in this. And this was something that, you know, was a real attempt. Maybe some of the ideas weren't the best ideas, but they were coming from the right place. And so, we built an exhibit that went through the history of the system, which is actually really interesting. The most interesting thing to me is, long story short, Atari, you know, hadn't really been a big name in home video games since the early 80s. We're coming up on like 1993. They launched this system that Christmas season. It is the most powerful system on the market, basically. But the software support is just never there. They kind of went from, you know, 0 to 60 in terms of the tech, and like no one there knew how to make games for something this advanced. Like, you know, they're going from like the 7800 and the Lynx to like full 3D polygonal stuff immediately. And they just don't know how to do it. And so it never catches on. But what becomes really interesting is that I would like to get the story behind this one day. I don't know. But at some point, do you remember, Phil, maybe like 2001 or something when it opened up somewhere around there?
Right. You mean in terms of the patents and all that?
Well, basically, like in terms of, so the system goes out and it launches and it dies. And then Hasbro purchases Atari. And for some reason, Hasbro puts out an announcement and everything to say that the Atari Jaguar is now an open system and anyone can make games for it and it's fine. And that is not something that I think has ever happened with a video game console.
And it's also weird that it's Hasbro. Like, it's not like it got like sold to, you know, an Atari fan or something. Yeah, that feels like one well-placed person making an argument for something. But yeah, I wonder what that story is. We don't know the other side of that.
But that creates, you know, a continued interesting history for the system where, you know, there's things like aftermarket, way after the fact, official port of Another World, the Eric Chahi adventure game, which is an amazing game. And it's like there's an official Jaguar game that came out after Atari was done with the Jaguar. So we had this really great exhibit that Robin, I'm just so grateful for you and your mom to helping set that up.
Yeah, that was
up.
Sweet that she came to help.
Sweet. And anything jump out at you that you want to talk about from the exhibit part of it?
Okay, so I was at the dentist last week.
Nice. Like, yeah.
For those of you who know, you know, I was like, should I tell them about this weird coincidental thing? I'm like, no, I got that. They won't. I don't think they'll care, but I am going back like in a couple weeks to get a feeling fixed. So like maybe I'll get the courage up to mention the whole like Atari system Jaguar mold was sold and made a dental camera, which of course we had at the show.
There's got to be some very confused listeners right now. Frank, what's the deal here?
Sure. First of all, of course it was at the show is really underselling it because it's never been functional at a show ever until this show that we did.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was a world debut outside of like a dental conference. after Atari had abandoned the system and moved on and gotten sold, et cetera, sort of meanwhile, here near us, actually in Belmont, California, there's a company called Imagen. It's Imagen without the E at the end. They make dental imaging equipment. And the guy who, the engineer who makes that had one in the pipe and he was working on it. He's sort of finalizing the internal guts of it and how it worked and things like that. Dental imaging, essentially like camera in your mouth to look at what's going on. So he's almost done and he goes to this injection molding company. So basically injection molding is just think about anything that has a plastic shell, like a video game console. Like you need to make a metal mold that you put the plastic in so that it cures and sets up and that's how it's done. He goes and he's like, I need a shell for my system. And the story is I've been told is they went, this video game company just went out of business or something. And like, I think your stuff would fit in here. And they brought the Atari Jaguar molds. And he's like, yeah, sold. Like, so at a discount, he didn't have to make a new mold. He purchased the Jaguar system molds and he made this dental camera that if you look at it, it's just a white Atari Jaguar with like the camera tubes coming out of it. And
because how much would a new mold have cost him? We have that number, right?
I don't know that we have that number, but my understanding is like a mold of that caliber is in like the five figures, it's like thousands. I don't think he sold very many of them. A lot of the reason that I've been told is just because like by that time, straight up video AV video signal stuff was already kind of getting antiquated and there was new tech coming, but a few survived. There's been, I think there's like four or five known period and like just loose systems not hooked up to anything have been shown off before. But Jesse, who works with the guy who made the system, offered to come like fix it up and bring the fully functioning unit. And what we had on display was actually the demo unit that he brought to like dental conferences and stuff. So for the first time, we set it up where you could take your pictures of your teeth essentially on an Atari Jaguar, sort of. I spent that whole week trying to convince people to take pictures of their teeth. Weekend, sorry. Very few did, although a lady on the last day of the show was like, yeah, I want to do that because she's really proud of her teeth. Like she put a lot of work into getting like orthodontic work to make her teeth look good. And they were good teeth, y'all. Like they were really, really good teeth. I was wondering if people would like, so we actually set up like a video printer and we had a CRT and everything and you could look at your teeth live. And, at first I thought maybe people would like donate money to get like a souvenir picture of their teeth from the Atari Jaguar. The only time you're ever going to be able to do this in your entire life. And everyone's shy about their teeth. And I was even like, okay, it's like people would ask, can I take a picture of like my face? Can I take a selfie? I was like, no, you can take a picture of your teeth and I will give it to you for free, but it has to be your teeth. And very few people took me up on that. if you want a selfie, that's the Game Boy camera on the other side of the room.
Right.
That's that part. There was an extension of, first of all, we should also say that the second half of the room, returning from the previous year, was the Art of Nintendo Power exhibit, run by our friend Stefan Rees, who kind of put on this exhibit with us. It was a joint venture between us and his org, the Interactive Art Collective. collective collection. Sorry, Stefan. I'm not sure which one it is. Art of Nintendo Power, for those who don't know, or maybe didn't attend our live event last year, is an exhibit of the original art for the covers and for some of the internal drawings that was used in the production of Nintendo Power magazine. And Stefan has been collecting this for years, and his organization, you know, is to be a sort of traveling art gallery of video game art, and Nintendo Power has been sort of their focus for a while. So half the room was full of original paintings and sketches, and Robin, you probably saw the claymation figures and stuff that he had under glass on that side of the room. Yeah.
It's interactive art collection.
Thank you. Yeah. I had it right the second time. just really, really cool stuff. And God, we're so thankful for him coming and like filling the space.
And he had that giant Mario costume you could take a picture with. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. He had a Mario mascot costume from the early 90s that he acquired and has been trying to restore. And his face isn't quite right, but he's doing his best. And
good job, Mario. Good job.
It was another photo op in addition to the teeth, was a selfie with Mario.
Did anyone get a picture of Mario's teeth?
No, but we did get a Game Boy camera picture of Mario. But Mario's mouth is closed.
Yeah, it's mostly just mustache. There's not a whole lot of mouth.
Oh, okay.
If he had exposed teeth, I think we would have done that.
I guess that would be weird to have like a mascot costume of Mario with like giant teeth. I think not successful.
I did get a souvenir photo of all of my teeth, but one close up of my bottom row, because the next week I got one of them pulled forever. So
a little commemorative.
Little in memoriam of that tooth. My teeth are fine, folks. It's just my Invisalign treatment that I'm at the beginning of right now, my Invisalign journey. We decided the best approach would be to literally get rid of a tooth, because that's how crowded that stuff was down there. And it will straighten out and look amazing in a year, but I have a very comical gap right now.
Besides dental equipment...
That's the update since the last podcast, is that I have a gap on the bottom row of my teeth now.
I was going to say, besides dental equipment and Mario, I understand that the Atari Jaguar Museum also had something else in it, too.
The best thing.
That's right. Interactive kiosks where you could play 6 Jaguar games.
Frank.
We're getting there.
You know.
I know. We did have interactive kiosks that I want to talk about for a second, because we built these small kiosks to play Jaguar games that were using... Big PMU, the emulator written by Rich Whitehouse of the Video Game History Foundation. And it was really cool to be able to... I like bringing emulation into exhibits, because I think people are so stuck on playing on the original hardware, because the most important thing is that you're holding that it's running on... It's like, no. I think emulation is the future of revisiting the past. And so... I really liked being able to, I don't even think we had a functioning Jaguar in the exhibit now that I think about it. Like, we just used emulation because there's no reason not to. So big thanks to Rich for not only, making this amazing emulator, the first time the Jaguar has been properly emulated, but he also built a feature for us that I'm really proud of. We had one kiosk that was a roulette wheel of Jaguar games. You would mash a button and it would pick a random one, and then you were stuck playing whatever that was.
Rolled again.
Yeah, that's true. You could roll again. It'd be funny if there was a countdown timer or something.
Yeah, you're just
like,
genuinely
you cannot re-roll
stuck
for 2 minutes. Yeah. we heard a lot of, what was the song we heard the most often? Maybe Right Now by Van Halen, but one of the games was VidGrid, which is a Jaguar CD game where you watch very 90s music videos and rearrange them sliding puzzle style, and Enter Sandman and Give It Away, and I don't remember what else. But yes, the thing that you want to talk about, why don't you tell us, Robin, about the part you want to talk about?
Okay. Frank had an amazing idea while we were putting together, like, what should we do at the show? And it ended up coming through, which I was really surprised it happened. And we got a local to Portland cat shelter to come in. Actually, they're an animal. They took in more than just cats, but they came in and brought kittens, cuddle
tiny
tents.
Jaguars.
tiny jaguars. And they even, like, it was so sweet. The cuddle tent is something they've done before, but they hadn't, like, been kind of at a show like a game, retro game show. And so the woman who was the volunteer.
It's possible this is the only time a pet rescue has been a retro game show. Yes.
She brought in these little like leopard or jaguar print fabric handkerchiefs for the kittens, but they kept getting like, they're so tiny. They kept getting like their arms stuck through the neck hole and stuff. And so for most of them, we just took them off for their own little safety. But oh, they were so cute.
What's a cuddle tent, Robin?
So there was like this pop-up tent and you could see through it on all sides. It was just kind of mesh. And so the kittens were enclosed and safe. And if you donated $5, you could spend 5 minutes all by yourself inside a cuddle tent with like 6 kittens. Or, you know, you could rent a friend with you if you wanted. It was just, it was the best part of the whole weekend.
And we raised, I don't remember how much money for them, but like went way past their goal, I think.
It was did.
I think it was booked the entire time.
$1,500 for them, and they were really excited and really, I mean, we were grateful that they made so much. Like, we wanted it to be successful for them.
What were you going to say about kittens, Phil?
I was going to say, I remember the original idea you had was to do an adoption booth, but then once you talk to them, they revealed they did the cuddle tents. Like, one, that was a much more fun idea, but two, we realized it connected back to a bit of Atari Jaguar lore, which is one of the earliest magazine reviews of the Atari Jaguar, from what we understand, was written when the author was on LSD, and it ends with him proclaiming, "Atari is back, come pet the cat." Which has worked its way into the Atari Jaguar scene as this kind of, you know, it's a phrase that is repeated. So you had a sign that
was the sign, yeah.
Yeah, that said, come pet the cats. And it was the advertisement for...
Yeah, which the Jaguar diehards understood. There's something about people who put on retro game shows and the Jaguar. They all like the Jaguar. I don't get it. Hmm. Like Midwest Gaming Classic started as Jagfest, for example. It's I don't get it. So
next year we have to find a way to shoehorn cat cuddle tents into whatever theme the museum is.
Well, that's the thing. They want to come back. The show wants them back. I don't care about the theming. There's just, well, Rick Weiss of the show was like, can we give them their own room? I don't think I said no, but no. Like,
you want them,
that's what got people in the door to the museum. They came to see the cats. I had friends I hadn't seen in years, like, just be like, oh, hey, and let's walk past me to, like, go to the kittens. It was great.
I'm sorry, Frank. I didn't mean to. No.
See, we're talking about how we don't do a good job publicizing ourselves. I think what we really need is just cat distractions around. I think the library landing page is just cat videos. And then it's like, oh, also, we have meeting minutes if you want to read those, too. I think that's the lead-in to get people to check out our stuff.
We could start digitally collecting from cat adoption websites any cats named after video game characters.
There you go.
My friend Al's cat is named Game Boy. We can put him up there.
Excellent. Phil, is there anything you want to talk about related to our now famous 87% report that we had a previous episode on? Has there been any updates since we launched that report?
Yeah. So this is something I do want to follow up on, because I think for a lot of folks, it was a big, scary number. And it's like, oh, goodness, these games are out of print. Well, that sucks. But we are making movement on this. I believe in August, the Software Preservation Network formally made a petition with the U.S. Copyright Office to make exemptions to the anti-tampering section of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act to allow for secure remote access to out-of-print video games. So we are working our way through that process now. My understanding is that by the end of this month, they will submit their formal, like, full comments for, like, here's what we're planning to do. Here's why this is important. Here's the information. And we're a big part of that. Like, the study that we wrote, and that, you know, people have supported us to, like, our people's donations have allowed us to, like, take time to write this thing. Like, that is going to be submitted to the U.S. Copyright Office to make the case for allowing broader exemptions for game preservation. And then that'll work its way through over the next year. I think there will probably be hearings in the spring. I'm expecting to be, you know, wearing a suit and showing up on a Zoom call to talk about game preservation with the Copyright Office. And hopefully by this time next year, we'll know how this goes. But we're working our way through, and it's continuing to make hay. I'm noticing we have this, like, every month or two, another library or copyright organization reaches out. It's like, hey, we're doing a panel about video games and copyright. We want you to talk on it. Like, people are noticing. Like, I think we got a big splash when it was first published. Obviously, there's a ton of press coverage, but now it's getting noticed by people in, like, copyright policy and the library world, and it's starting to really make an impact in a meaningful way. We could see some meaningful reforms to copyright law in the span of the next year, which is crazy. Like, that's really exciting that we're able to help with that change. So things are continuing to move, and it has already made a difference.
I mean, let's kind of talk about where we're heading next year. I mean, we alluded to this already, right? Because the big thing for us going into the future is this notion of a library, but it's also this notion of talking more, right? And so
showing and telling.
Yeah, exactly. We're not good at show and tell, and it's something that you know, it's not necessarily that we're getting complaints about that, but I think a lot of people who aren't, you know, for example, listeners of the show, people in our Discord, right? A lot of people who aren't, like, super invested in us and like a part of our community, don't really have a sense of what day to day is and you know, what it is that we do and what we're building toward. And so, you know, being able to, like, transparency is a word that keeps coming to mind for me. Like, I want to get better at transparency, and it's not that I'm shy about what we do. It's just that, like, it's been really difficult to be able to show something of value, because so much of this has been, I wish I could think of a better word here, but building the foundation of the foundation, right? Like, it's been setting up, the things that will make this a success. It's been, I mean, Phil, how long did you spend just, like, cataloging the catalog of video game magazines so that we could populate it, you know?
Yeah. And it's still probably not done at this point. Like, there's like, short run issues. Yeah. We have a lot more to go. The way I'm thinking about it was the comparison that came to mind originally. I was like, oh, we've been spending 2 years making a sausage and now we have one sausage. But it's not even that. It's like, we spent 2 years making the machine that makes sausage, and now we're making sausage. Like, that's the kind of stuff we had. So maybe that's slightly more gross and interesting than the foundation for the foundation comparison. But yeah, so we've been building the sausage machine. I think is the I don't like that.
There's kind of a sausage. Well, there's kind of a sausage factory implication, I think. So. But
point being, we had to build the thing to build the thing is
absolutely
what we've been working
on. Yeah.
And my hope, and this is unproven, but again, going back to what we were talking about earlier, this countdown calendar is us testing the waters and whether we can do this. My hope is that we can sort of build the system where it becomes a lot easier to, like, get the thing, catalog the thing, talk about the thing. And both of you have seen my sort of internal or even external, if anyone listening was at Portland Retro, this sort of, like, three-tiered notion, this compulsion loop, this feedback loop of what we do. We get the thing, we catalog the thing, we talk about the thing. In talking about the thing, we get opportunities and or money to go get more things and repeat that cycle. And I think for an organization like us, that's what makes sense. Like, we're not a museum, you know, we're not something that can sustain ourselves by charging fee at the door, right? I also, you know, thinking way back, it was like when I started this thing, when I was trying to think of a business model, because even a nonprofit has to be a business, it sucks. I was like, okay, maybe we're building, like, a product that universities license, right? Like, maybe we're a LexisNexis, but for video game history or something. And I don't think that's realistic either, right? I think that and you're just getting raw thoughts, folks. This is the kind of access you get on the show. I think that really we're forever kind of being this weird idea of video game history should be accessible online, period. And we're trying to feed ourselves while making that possible. And I think that loop is what makes the most sense. And so that's kind of what we're exploring going into next year. And long story short is, you know, we want to talk more, and We want to show off more. We want to demonstrate what it is that you do with our product, which, by the way, has always been the point of us even making content, is to sort of demonstrate what it is that contemporary video game history material can do in the hands of a good historian, right? We're next year is all about sort of at least launching a version of this vision, getting people actually using it. Phil, I think going back to what you were saying earlier about people already digging into the small drip feed of content we're doing and like already starting to at least speculate on new stories, if not starting to, you know what I mean, uncover them. Like, I think that's kind of proof of what we're going for.
Exactly. Yeah. I think you've mentioned this idea you described as priming the market for research. And I think about that a
lot. Stoking the market.
Stoking the market. Excuse me. But
From Simon Carlos. Sorry. That's okay. Credit to Simon.
Thank you, Simon. I think about that in the context of some of the stuff in our collection that doesn't really fit the winter fundraiser. Like, this is a weird example, but we've been sharing things from the collection of Mark Flitman. We've been sharing cool, fun stuff like the E3 video. But the stuff that kind of gets me excited is stuff where it's not as obvious. Like, he worked on a lot of licensed games. So a lot of things you have is like correspondence with license holders and contracts for doing like developing Marvel and DC games on the Super Nintendo. And like, I think there's a neat story in there. We can say, hey, did you want to know how licensed games are made? Here's some documents. You can dig into these. And I think we're getting kind of the first draft of that right now with this fundraiser, where it's like, hey, here are some of the juicier things in our collection that are more obviously like, you know, something that you could just go, like, whoa, cool robot. I keep saying, wow, cool robot, but that's kind of my thought process on this. I think it's a good exercise. And I think once we open the floodgates to what we have cataloged and archived so far, we'll have things we're interested in. I'm excited for the things I'm not catching. Like, I think there's some things where obviously to me, it's like, that's a cool story. Not to spoil it, but there is one thing. It was like a bunch of documents across a couple different folders in Mark's collection that all describe wildly different games. And I realized, oh wait, this is the same game that just changed concept radically over the course of a year. So like, there's something cool there, but I'm sure there's things we're not noticing that like someone who's like a real fan of XYZ is going to dig into and find some exciting story about. And that gets me real psyched.
I'm pretty excited about that with some content coming up. I'm going to tease a little bit, although I think people who are really invested in this kind of thing already are at least a little bit familiar with this. Part of our countdown calendars, we're publishing some work related to the development of Sonic the Hedgehog 2 that's never been seen before. And we're exposing some things about some levels that were cut from the final game that no one has seen before. And there is, much like Mark Flitman, there is a digital collection of physical material from someone who worked on the game that we're putting out there for people to dig through. And very similarly, Phil, I'm so excited for like the Sonic fans who obsess over this more than I do. And I am, you know, above the threshold of normality for this. So I already obsess a little bit.
You're above the threshold for normality, but like the Sonic fan threshold is like stratosphere. Right. You can get like, you can become like a Sonic freak if you want.
Yeah. You can supersonic your way into knowing too much about this stuff. But,
I once had a dream I was Sonic. I have to go fast.
I want to put the podcast on hold and hear about this.
I woke up and told Steve. He got so excited.
So your subconscious idea of Sonic the Hedgehog is like, he has to run. Like, it's
run
like the movie Speed.
Or die.
It's like a movie Speed, right? Like, it's like, if I don't run, I will explode.
It's not wanna run fast. It's gotta go fast.
You have to.
Yeah, that's right.
You both are like unable to talk right now. Like, I didn't expect you both to find that so funny.
Well, I'm just fascinated by the idea of Sonic has to run or he dies.
He has it's to like, run, yeah.
Like,
that's
like
why when
shark.
You just stand, like when you're idle and he's like looking at you and looks at his watch, he's like, dude, I'm gonna explode. You have to go. Like,
well, and in fact, in Sonic CD, if you idle for too long, he goes, I'm out of here, and he leaves and the game resets. So he knows,
it like all
he's
fits.
Like, I can't wait
it
any
fits
longer.
The lore.
Your subconscious had it. But yeah, I'm really excited to see what new Sonic 2 stuff comes out of this. And in fact, right after this call, well, I'll eat lunch, but then I'm working on a rough cut of the video. Let's sort of wrap this up. Just a reminder, like we talked about at the top of the show, but we're doing cool stuff every day through Christmas. It's all on gamehistory.org/donate. There's this interactive calendar there. While you're there, you know, if you're able to donate, awesome. Like every dollar helps, as people who know us and listen to this podcast know. But we'd actually really like you if you'd like to hear from us more in your email inbox. We're trying to get people onto our email newsletter list. So there's a sign up form there as well. That's where we tend to anytime we have something substantial to say, or publish new content, or, you know, anything cool going on, we're trying to use the email list to do that. Frankly, because we just don't believe in the future of social media at this point. So we're trying to sort of make sure that people who want to engage with us are still able to do that. Honestly, it's a big part of why we're recording this right now, because we feel like a lot of you listening to this might be the only way you even hear from us. We are still planning to have something on this feed next year. Like, we're still planning some kind of audio something, but we haven't quite figured that out yet. But if you'd like to hear from us more often in other forms, you know, I want to extend that invite to you right now, gamehistory.org/donate, and sign up for our email list, and you'll hear from us a little more often. And if you do that during this month, you'll hear from us every day, because we're emailing you a new video game history calendar treat every day through Christmas. I'm so tired.
I'm so tired too, but this is what excites me. We were talking, Simon Carlos on our board was visiting the office a while back, and he was like, man, you're like burning through a lot of really good content. And it was like, oh, we haven't even showed the good stuff yet.
Like, right. We've been purposefully like trying to keep it easy. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I did advocate for just going ahead and dumping during this, you know, countdown calendar, because part of it is like setting us up to receive more content.
Yeah.
More stuff to talk about, and pushing us to, well, let's find something more interesting to talk about if we just blow through all the stuff that we have. But also, yeah. The Patreon, they get people on Patreon, on our Patreon, get access to every day, one day early as well.
That's right. Yeah.
And for some of it, like as we're recording, as of today's treat, it's a giveaway, and so that one day early really matters.
That's right. Yeah. The giveaway, we'll just say, because it is public now, is rental codes for Mother to Earth, the documentary that we previously did an episode on the Video Game History Hour about with Bones, the director. Anything else you guys want to wrap up with?
For everyone who has donated for our winter fundraiser, we thank you very, very much. And even if you're just a regular listener, we thank you for coming back to listen to this little update episode. Yeah. Oh, on that vein, I did get so many emails, because last time we all talked on the show, Frank, you put the call out to send emails, and we did get so many. They're very sweet and kind and loving. So thank you, everybody who has sent your message. If you want to send a message, it's podcast@gamehistory.org.
Yeah, please do. Go ahead, Phil.
I would add that even if you aren't able to donate this year, let us know what you think of the stuff we're sharing. Like, leave some positive comments on YouTube. Like, we're reading all those, and it helps us figure out, what's resonating with people. And
exactly, because this isn't just about raising money at the end of the year. It's also, like, honestly, just trying to figure out, like, what are we doing next year? Like, part of that is, you know, the dollar amount, right? The dollar amount helps inform us, like, okay, how many trips can we take to acquire new things, right? For example, but it's not just the dollars. It's also like, okay, we want to talk more next year. What is it that we're talking about that excites people? So,
what do people want to hear?
Yeah. So direct feedback, awesome. Let us know. But, YouTube videos, go comment when we're publishing those. Honestly, send the email to podcast@gamehistory.org. If you've got any commentary on what excited you on the calendar and stuff like that. But even if you say nothing, you know, we're monitoring traffic and stuff like that. So like we're seeing what people are clicking on and sort of gauging where we spend our time and focus on, not in terms of archiving, you know, everything is archived, but in terms of making content around it, because we want to make sure everything that we do is really effective and is encouraging this idea of preserving video game history through us or otherwise. With that, I think we're good to wrap up. So I just want to echo Robin and Phil's thanks to everyone for sticking around, for listening to us, for donating if you have. All of our existing patrons, you are our VIPs. you're the ones that Patreon's just the last line of defense here, you know what I mean? Like, it is like we only exist if there's money coming into the Patreon, otherwise we can't. Yeah, we're also very, very thankful to you, and you'll be hearing from us again sooner rather than later. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, listeners.